4. The same dry east wind was singing next day in the pines of the mountainsides and lashing up whitecaps on Malafrena, bright and wild in the morning sun. Piera Valtorskar came wandering down the lane that led through the valley from the pass. To her right lay the stubble fields and orchards of Valtorsa, to her left the orchards and stubble fields of the Sorda estate. All things, trees, apples on the trees, clods, mountains, were distinct in the acute autumn light. Piera's hair blew loose, and her red skirt flashed in gusts of wind. In her left hand she carried an apple with a bite out of it, in her right a bunch of wild grass and flowers. Down from a side path along the Sorda apple orchard came a mounted horse with a neat, quick gait. Recognizing the fat mare and thin rider, Piera waved her wildflowers in the sunshine. Guide raised his hand in salute and came riding up to her.
"I thought, whose lass is that in her Sunday dress? But it's no one but thee in common clothes."
Sometimes he called her by her title. Sometimes he still used thou to her as to a child. She called him you and Mr. Sorda, but that was the extent of her formality with him. At times she pondered the questions. Did she love Mr. Sorda as much as she loved her father? Ought she to? And why did she? She found no answers, no scales for weighing love, no reasons. She loved him because he loved her. That she knew, better perhaps than he did. Not being responsible for her, he was free to show his feelings to her, as he was not free with his own daughter and son. He could play with Piera long years after he had ceased to tease and praise and play with Laura. He looked down at her now, smiling, seeing the flash of her red skirt, her blown hair, her clear, bright eyes, seeing her a frail, wild bit of the bright day of wind. His look was praise.
"I stole one of your apples, see? Should I put it back?"
"Eat it, eat it," said he.
"It's got a worm right through it."
"That's the serpent that tempted thee, Eve."
She looked up at him and laughed.
"May I feed it to Bruna? Are you in a hurry, Mr. Sorda?"
She stood at the mare's head, offering the apple. Bruna tossed her head and mouthed her bit, and Guida had to slap the bit out so she could eat Piera's apple. He did not mind humoring the girl and the willful old mare. The beauty of the morning put him in a patient mood, a mood that fit the season. He liked the autumn, above all seasons, because it brought him that quietness.
"You're going in to Portachenka, Mr. Sorda?"
Piera asked in a ladylike tone. She was always changing that way from country eve to proper miss, in a breath, for no reason.
"Aye." Guida shifted in the saddle and added the explanation, "The post comes in today."
"Oh, of course."
Piera scrubbed her horse-slobbered hand with Bruna's long mane, quite as a child would do, while remarking with womanly tact,
"And it's a lovely morning for a ride."
"And for escaping lessons, eh?" he teased her a little heavily.
"Oh, Miss Elizabeth never gets up till 8. I have hours and hours before lessons."
She was twining the one bright flower of her October nosegay, a last cornflower, into the mare's mane. When Guida had left her and was riding on towards town, his gaze fell on the blue nodding flower, and he felt a curious tenderness, an ache, as he looked at it. They passed on the road, she at 16 and he at 56, and she left him a blue cornflower twined in his horse's mane. It was queer, he thought, how you met and passed souls thus, and a few of them left sweetness with you. You passed one another and parted. It might as well be forever. And yet there remained the touch of sweetness and of pain. Piera wandered on towards Valtorsa, murmuring a French irregular verb. As she murmured, Her mind, also, wandered. The post came in today. It would stop high, dusty, swaying at the Golden Lion. On it, in one of the two or three mail sacks containing the fortnight's correspondence to all the people of the lakes, would be a letter to the Sordes, a square envelope of heavy, cheap paper, addressed in black ink, the corners bent and dirty from the long trip. These letters were thoroughly familiar to Piera. Eleonora and Laura read them alone, read them together, read them with Piera, read them to each other, quoted them, misquoted them, especially Eleonora, interpreted them, dreamed about them, and twice a month awaited them with a longing that made the post coach's delay a disaster, its arrival a festivity. Till now, one or both of the women had driven in to meet the post, and Piera wondered why this time Guida had gone. They were expecting something unusual, perhaps. That afternoon, when her lessons were over for the day, she told Miss Elizabeth that she was going to visit with Laura, and came straight along the lakeside path to the Sordas without any wanderings off to the side. By now she was certain that Itale was coming home. In fact, he had probably been on the coach. Laura was seeing out the old tutor, Mr. Chiovai of Portaceca, who came once a week to read French with her, as he came to Valtorsa to improve Piera's spoken French. He had improved the French of every young lady in Valmalafrena for 40 years, and the French spoken there did not resemble that spoken anywhere else on earth, being, to a considerable extent, Mr. Chiovai's own invention. He had taught Eleonora, now he taught her daughter, whom he liked, because she was quiet. But he dreaded Piera. He quailed as she came up the path beside the Mandevillia.
"Que je vince!"
she cried aloud at them.
"Que tu vince! Qu'il vint!"
Note. French. That I had come. That thou hadst come. That he had come. End note. She had mastered the past subjunctive of venir.
"Mais viens donc,"
said Laura.
"Vient-il?"
said Piera. Note. French. Come on, then. Is he coming? End note. Mr. Chiovai escaped while the girls went into the house.
"There was a letter, wasn't there?
Mama has it. I'll get it. They're going to have a journal. Itale's going to be an editor."
"But he's not..."
Piera did not finish. He was not coming home, of course. Whatever had possessed her to think he was? Laura prized the letter away from her mother, promising not to damage it or lose it, and went with Piera down to their favorite haunt on sunny afternoons, the lawn by the boathouse, now a sweep of golden green in the mellow light. Sitting there, Piera read and Laura reread Itale's letter. It was, as always, rather stiff, bookish, impersonal. He talked about plans for the journal. He attempted to describe Amade Estenskar, but on this subject his language became stuffier than ever, probably because he was self-conscious or overconscious of his readers as he wrote. There was a good deal of detail about the complexities of dealing with the bureaucrats at the censor's office, which was hard to follow. But the dry, stiff letter was permeated, penetrated, shot through and through with joy. A great work to do, the friendship of great spirits, the road open before him, the world to be renewed, and the strength to renew it.
"What became of that baron and baroness that he wrote about at first?"
Piera inquired, gazing out over the dark, bright lake.
"He hasn't mentioned them again," said Laura, folding the letter carefully. "Oh, dear. I wish..."
"What?"
"That I weren't envious of him."
Piera brooded over this for a while. It did not make much sense to her at first. Laura was Laura, and was here. Itale was Itale, and was there. Pierrot's mind did not easily mix the absent with the present. Her imagination did not move lightly in and out of possibilities, so she was seldom envious and seldom discontented. She was cautious about entering the realm of the possible, for when she did, her will came with her.
"It really isn't fair,"
she said at last,
"him getting all the excitement, and you none." "It isn't the excitement. It's just that he's doing something, being someone. I don't get bored. It isn't that. I am so dreadfully bored,"
Piera said nasally, imitating the eldest Sorrenti daughter, and she and Laura both giggled.
"I never get bored. I just feel unnecessary. It's what Itales says here about Mr. Estenskar. That's what I mean."
She already knew the sentence by heart.
"He seeks with all his strength to find the way that he and only he can, and hence must, follow. So is Itale trying to do that. And he will do it. But anybody in the world could do everything I do. Nobody else could be Laura Sorda, though. What's the use being me if I don't do anything? If you weren't you, what would I do? Who would I talk to? How could I even be me? Anybody can run around doing things, but nobody can be you except you. And I hope you never change."
"I won't change in what I love," Laura said. Her face was turned to the western sunlight and the dark reflecting bulk of San Lorenz Mountain above the lake.
"But you see, you're already in love. You've started on your way. I haven't. I have no way. I just wait and time goes by and by and by and life goes by. Surely I was made for more."
Pierrot did not answer for a while. She felt more than the 3 years' age difference between herself and Laura, the very great difference between 16 and 19 years old. She felt an inferiority of character that had nothing to do with age. She was in love, Laura said. And indeed, 6 weeks ago, she and Alexander Sorrenti had become secretly engaged, and she had rushed to tell Laura the secret and show her Alexander's carnelian ring on a chain around her neck. That was so, that was true. But as Laura spoke, Piera blushed, as if she had been caught stealing jam. She was engaged to be married, but she did not, in her deep heart, take it seriously. Laura did. It would never occur to Laura that one might experiment with betrothal or play at love, that one could even speak of being in love without having given one's whole heart. The little girl felt Alexander's carnelian ring a cold lump against her breastbone and thought, "I'm a pig, I'm a pig, I'm a pig."
"When you fall in love," she said, "it'll be with a tremendous man, a king. Nobody around here. A man from far away. A man like a lion. And you'll go away with him and see, oh, I don't know, Vienna and all the cities, and do wonderful things and write letters home. And I'll be envious."
"Silly," said Laura.
"What would I leave Malafrena for? Let's go to Vespers at St. Anthony's, Perry." "Oh, Miss Elisabeth wanted to. I forgot. Come on."
Piera jumped up like a branch suddenly released. Laura uncurled and followed her. They left the letter with Eleonora, went by Valtorsa for the pony cart and the governess, and got to St. Anthony's barely in time for the service. There at the base of San Lorenz, the sunlight was long gone. The granite chapel looked like a toy set down between the forested ridge and the deep curve of the lake. Inside the chapel smelled of stone, whitewash, balsam, pine. The two girls, the fat, quiet governess, a young peasant couple, and three old women were all that evening's congregation. They heard Vespers in the silence of the lonely place, in the growing cold of the mountain evening. When they came out, the far reaches of the lake were gray with dusk, and the water in the shadow of San Lorenz was streaked with a cold, strong, silent wind rising. Laura and the priest, Father Clement of Sinvilla, old friends, fell to talking, and there was a matter of arranging to have some firewood brought to the cottage of one of the old women, and then the priest came back with them in the pony cart for supper at the Sordes, so that Piera and Miss Elisabeth got home rather late, delaying supper at Valtorsa by a few minutes. After supper, Count Orlant, Miss Elisabeth, neighbor Rodena, and the Count's new overseer played whist. Vist, it was called in the Montaigne, and many autumn and winter evenings were given up to Vist. Auntie sat in her straight-backed chair, a ball of red yarn on her lap. Piera sat by the marble fireplace with her lesson book. She was supposed to write a composition on the duties of the young female. She hated to write compositions, or letters, or notes, or anything. They were always very dull, and then Miss Elisabeth made red circles around the misspellings. She had composed one sentence so far. Young girls should be obedient. O-B-E-I-D-I-E-N-T.
Auntie, would you like me to read to you?
No, my dear, said Auntie,
slowly, slowly rewinding the red yarn. Young girls should be obedient. Piera thought and thought. They should not argue or talk very much loudly. There are numerous things young girls should not do, but these are not duties. Her pen made a row of dots on the paper, then of its own accord drew three profiles of young men with large eyes and noses, facing left, and a lion with a curly mane facing right. Young girls should get M and have B, she wrote very small, and then crossed it out very black. It is important for them to learn their lessons, but less important than for young gentlemen to learn theirs, as they will find them more useful in life. They should be neat and orderly. The pen drew three maidens with Grecian noses, all facing left. Piera gave it up and began to watch the card players. Her father had his cards up under his nose, not because he was suspicious, but because he was nearsighted. Neighbor Rodena had a good hand and looked smug. He was a small landowner. Vist and hunting were his passions, and he had never married, stating that a wife would keep him from Vist and hunting. Miss Elisabeth looked, as usual, contented. She was a placid soul. Nothing stirred her. She praised God with a mild heart. Next to her, the new overseer, Gavre, looked thin and sharp as a knife blade. He was a Val Altesma man, and had been with Count Orlant only a month. Piera had not paid much attention to him, as he was always busy with papers and account books, speaking to her father, but not to her, and missing dinner more often than not because he was working in the office, or the orchards, or the fields. He was sitting quiet now, alert, studying the other players' faces. So Piera studied his. He was a good-looking man, thin-lipped, dark-eyed, with a ruddy brown complexion. The best thing about being engaged to Alexander, Piera thought, was that it gave her a safe refuge, a lookout tower, from which to look at other men. Since she was 12, she had been trying to fall in love. It was hard work. Falling in love with pictures, strangers glimpsed in Porta Ceca, heroes of romantic novels, and the few boys she met who were not put out of the running by warts or stupidity. It was hard work and unrewarding, but she kept at it. She practiced, as a musician practices on his violin, not cold-bloodedly, yet methodically, not for present profit or enjoyment, not because he longs to play each scale 10 times over, but because to play the violin well is his gift, his need, his job. So Piera practiced the art of love. She had known Alexander Sorrenti all her life, No social event took place along the northern lakeshore without representatives from the Sorrentai, Sorde, and Valtorskar families. In the last generation, the latter two had got few in numbers, even to the point where the Valtorskar name would die with Piera. But the Sorrentais abounded. There were never less than 15 of them under the dynastic roof, northwest of Valtorsa in the flank valley of Sinvia Mountain. The senior family of the estate had 6 children, 3 girls and 3 boys, all tall and boisterous, except the eldest, Alexander, who was short and quiet. He was Laura's age, and when they were both 16, he had written her a long love letter, embellished with quotations from the new Eloise, which his mother had borrowed from Eleonora the year before and forgotten to return. Laura had shown the letter almost at once to her mother, who counseled inaction. Nothing had come of it, except a lasting embarrassment for both Laura and Alexander. At every party, the memory of the letter lay like a tombstone between them. For 3 years, they danced together at every dancing party in stony and tormented silence. It was a great relief to Laura when she could hand Piera over to Alexander and do her dancing with Papa Sorrentai, the uncles, the cousins, the brother-in-law, and the rest of the inexhaustible fund of Sorrentais. This handing over took place at the August ball, the ball they had discussed one July evening by the lake, the ball to which Piera wore a white gown with gold flowers embroidered down the bodice, her first evening gown. Alexander gawped at her as if he had never seen her. Indeed, he never had. In her first evening gown, Piera was new as the newborn, her childhood left behind, her womanhood fresh from the hands of God and the seamstress. By midnight, Alexander had decided that if she would not marry him, life was meaningless. 3 weeks later, in the evening of a long, loud picnic day in the pine forest across the lake, he climaxed a spasmodic but earnest wooing with the offer of marriage. Piera accepted at once.
"Yes," she said. She was sitting on a fallen log near a stream.
Alexander hovered about her, not daring either to kneel or sit down.
"May I speak to your father?" he said.
"Perhaps we should wait a while," she said.
She gave no reason why, and he asked none. They agreed without discussion that the engagement should be kept secret. Neither thought to ask why. They were in perfectly good faith. Alexander, experiencing real desire, never questioned that he was in love. Piera was more aware that they were playing a game, yet it was not a game to her. What she was playing was the moto perpetuo, or the tarantella that follows the well-practiced scales. A beginner's piece, but music. Note: moto perpetuo, Italian, perpetual motion, is a musical composition or pattern of continuously repeated rapid notes. The tarantella is a popular dance form in triple time, 3/8 or 6/8, named for the belief that dancing oneself into a state of exhaustion would sweat out the poison of a tarantula bite. End note. She did not know why he said he would marry her. She said she would marry him because she needed to practice her art. She scarcely thought about their getting married. They were engaged to be married, betrothed. That was enough for the present. They deceived each other. Piera deceived him more than he did her, and they deceived themselves. He deceived himself more than Piera did herself. But they were quite happy. Piera looked up into Alexander's blocky, callow face, and he looked down at her sitting on the log, and said,
"My bride."
Later on, he said,
"Our properties touch, you know, at Galia's Hill."
He was the principal heir to the Sorrentai property. Piera was the only heir to Valtorsa. The joined estates would be an excellent holding. Piera found it very interesting that he had seen this and thought about it. She admired him for doing so. Her father was an impractical man, inept at the management of his property, and miserable when he had to deal with money matters. Guida Sorde was always trying to set him straight. But Guida, though a good farmer and manager, was not a practical man either. He loved the work, not the profit from it. Alexander saw the work neither as a punishment nor an end in itself, but as a means to an end. He preferred work in the estate office to the fields, and had been his father's accountant for 2 years. All his talk of loss and profit, income and outlay, was quite new to Piera, and she listened with deep interest to all he told her. That intelligent interest and her honest and unqualified admiration of his talents soon won Alexander to her with a bond stronger, perhaps, than his desire. The sweetest moment of it all for Piera was when she told Laura that she was betrothed. She felt triumph. Laura felt envy. But those were mere emotions, twinges, straw on the current of their friendship. Piera's love affair brightened Laura's life, a life that ran too quiet and too solitary. While without Laura, Piera would not have enjoyed her betrothal very much at all. Indeed, she preferred talking about Alexander with Laura to being with Alexander himself. She did not see him often, as he could not call on her openly. She had requested secrecy, and a call from a young man on a young woman in that small, watchful society was as good as a proposal. They met in secret, and Laura's connivance was needed to arrange the meetings. She was as drunk with the romance of it all as Piera and Alexander. She waited on guard on the lawn beneath the stars, tense and ecstatic, while they whispered in the shadow of the boathouse. She was, perhaps, happier than they. They had kissed once, the first evening. Given abruptly and received awkwardly, the kiss had landed near Piera's ear. After it, neither had dared move. They had held still so long their necks began to ache. Piera had tried with all her heart to feel delighted, but not even when she was alone could she manage it, and she did not mention the kiss to Laura. Alexander did not offer to repeat it. At most, he held her hand, and when he did, his was wet. She did not much like that soft, nervous touch, and as they talked, would contrive to withdraw her own hand, and he would not notice. Once, in one of the endless conversations that were their chief pleasure, Laura had said,
"You know, Perry, I can tell you something now."
"What? What? What?"
"Nothing, really. I used to wonder what it would be like if you and Itale fell in love. You know how you think things like that, just arranging the world to suit yourself."
Piera nodded.
"It wouldn't have done at all, really."
"Why not?"
"Oh, his politics, and both your tempers. And anyhow, he isn't Alexander."
As she sat by the fire, her composition on The Duties of the Young Female on her knee, Piera thought again of that brief conversation, of Laura's wistful, teasing, loving look, and the same chill of fear ran through her. Fall in love with Itale. Marry him? No. That was something altogether different from Alexander Sorrenti, and being engaged and holding hands. That was no game she could play, nothing she could manage. It was not to be thought of, nor was he to be thought of, the scent of Mandevilla, and the roar of summer rain, and the door open, and he standing there. She had not read the book he had given her, The New Life. It stood in her bookshelf in her room, and she never took it out. And she had believed this morning that he was coming back. That was nonsense. He was not coming back. He was gone. Auntie's eyes had closed. Her fingers lay motionless on the red yarn. Young girls should be obedient. They should be neat and orderly. Piera yawned, and neighbor Rodene said, grinning from the card table,
"Don't swallow the fireplace, Contessina."
Voices and steps outside. Piera bounced up. Visitors, thank God. It was Father Clement, wanting a word with Count Orlant about the next meeting of the Catholic Men's Sodality of Val Malafrena, and the Sordes come along with him for the walk. Eleonora had brought some new silks for Auntie.
"Is your rheumatism any better, Auntie dear?"
she asked, and the old lady, raising her clear gray eyes from sleep without the least surprise, said,
"No."
Guida and neighbor Rodena fell to talking hounds. Piera went off to the kitchen to stir up the cook, for Count Orlant never let a guest leave unfed. The new overseer rose from the interrupted Vist game to stretch his legs and warm his back at the fire. Laura, who had seen him only a few times before, asked politely,
"Are you liking it here at Malafrena, Mr. Gavre?"
"Aye, miss," he answered.
She blushed, as she always did when talking to a stranger. That was all their conversation. As the Sordes went home by the lakeshore path, Laura asked,
"What sort of man is Count Orlant's new overseer, Father?"
"A considerable improvement. He may get the estate run something like properly, if he keeps at it."
"I can't find out much about him," said Eleonora. "Of course he's not one of the Gavres from Culme. It's Gavre. His father's a farmer, freeholder, near Mor Altesma. He's the second son. He's very close-mouthed. None of the women at Valtorsa know a thing about him. I hope he's honest. How can you trust a close-mouthed man?"
"You can trust him not to blabber," Guida said with dry good humor.
He was still in the good mood of the early morning. He breathed the night air of autumn as they walked, felt his body as straight and lithe as ever, and held his wife's arm in his own. 56 wasn't the worst time of life. It was pleasant to walk home in the darkness of October, under pines and stars, between two well-beloved women. When Laura bade him good night before going upstairs, he kissed her and sketched the cross on her hair, as he did rarely since she was grown. Eleonora watched and thought,
"You have your daughter, but I do not have my son."
But the flicker of bitterness was lost as she looked at Laura's face. All evening long, as always when she was tense or troubled, Laura's likeness to her brother had been very strong. Itale had been in the turn of her head, in the tone of her voice. On whose head had Guida set his blessing? His eyes, his hands, were kinder than his head, and wiser. She followed Laura upstairs after a little. As she passed the empty bedroom, something moved, a figure between the doorway and the gray starlit window.
"I thought you were in bed. I wanted to look at the lake."
In her white nightgown, Laura was very tall and thin, a white crane startled from the reeds at night.
"You're barefoot. Come to bed before you catch a pleurisy."
She followed Laura to her bedroom, which looked out onto the valley, the orchards, San Givan, dark against stars. The window was half open, letting in the sweet, dry odors of an autumn night in farmlands. Laura curled up in bed. Her mother sat down by her. Her long, thin hand lay on the coverlet, and the girl looked at it and at the wedding ring of soft gold, worn thin.
"Mama, when you fell in love first with your father, not the cavalry lieutenant?"
Eleonora laughed, and her underlip drew in, demure and sly.
"Oh, no, that was just mustaches. And the boots. Can people fall in love intentionally?"
Eleonora considered.
"I really don't know. It sounds very odd. But I believe, well, so much of love comes after marriage, at least for us."
She meant for women.
"I don't believe one can force an inclination. But if it is there, one can certainly improve upon it."
They sat in peaceable silence for a minute, the girl thinking forward, the woman thinking back.
"Wasn't Father Clement funny about the soup?"
They both laughed.
"I never see him,"
said Eleonora. "But I think of the gray hen Eva was so fond of. Do you remember it? It had such a peculiar way of clucking when it laid an egg. He sounds very like it."
They both laughed again. Guida's step was on the stairs, coming up. Eleonora rose. She looked at her daughter with her head a little to one side.
"You're sad," she said.
"Oh, no."
The mother said nothing, but continued to gaze.
"I miss Itale, on letter nights."
"It's high time we answered Matilda's letter."
Eleonora's brother Angele Drew and his wife Matilda, in Solari, had invited Laura to stay with them over the winter.
"I'd rather go in spring,"
Laura said imploringly.
"The winter down there would be good for your chest, and some new faces at Christmas. Well, we really must think about it, dear. Put your feet under the covers. Do you breathe through your toes? Good night, my darling."
Eleonora blew out the candle on the chest of drawers and went out, a little round figure in the darkness. Laura did not lie down, but put her feet obediently under the covers. With her arms round her knees, she sat for a long time looking out at the mountain and the hazy stars beside and above it, flaring in the gulfs of night and autumn and the wind.